It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Today, food for thought. Say we go out for brunch. You want bacon and sausage. I go for the tofu scramble. You order a decaf mochaccino soy latte. I don't know what that is. Taste can seem so incredibly individual, as though no two people could possibly share all the same likes and dislikes. But beyond individual taste buds, there are vast social and economic trends and even hidden tastemakers shaping the foods we eat. Like cupcakes. Remember how they used to come in two flavors, chocolate or vanilla, and they were served at children's birthday parties? And then, almost overnight, they were transformed into upscale, decadent desserts for grown-ups. How does that happen? Journalist David Sachs investigates in his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Sarah Nix caught up with him.
It seems like over the past 10 years, food has become the next great mark of cultural savvy. Do you have any idea why knowing about the next big food trend or the latest hot chef or the best fermentation recipe has become equivalent to, say, being in the loop about music or art or films?
Yeah. You know, my wife loves to say that food is our new culture, that chefs are our rock stars and our artists, and that's how we value things today. And I think it's for a couple reasons. One is that food and cooking went really since the mid-90s and the rise of the Food Network and became a form of entertainment. And I think it grew because it is accessible to everyone. You know, opera is something that's accessible to only people who really understand it and live in an area where there's opera and can kind of afford to go. Art is the same thing. You know, there's not a lot of art shows that people go to. It's not sort of the most accessible form of culture to the masses. And the other forms of culture have been kind of devalued, right? Music is now something you just get whenever you want, however you want. And there's no real challenge to it. You just download billions of songs at the touch of a finger. Same with film and television and movies. But, you know, food still requires an effort. You have to go and pay an amount of money to get it. You can't just click and get it for free. It's an analog form of culture and remains so. You can't digitize food. So you could talk about it and share it virally, but it's still a very human experience. And because of that, you know, everybody has access to it in some way, whether it's people talking about cupcakes and sharing recipes about them or someone going to Alinea or some really fancy restaurant in Chicago and paying $300 for dinner and discussing that and posting photos of it and, you know, critiques of it on Yelp or whatever.
It's fascinating to me how sticky these trends are, these fads are. You know, I heard a couple of years ago about this bone luge thing where you scoop the marrow out of a roasted beef shank bone and then you pour port. You drink the port from the scooped out bone. And it seemed completely absurd. But of course, I went and did it anyhow. I mean, why do you think they're so attractive sometimes, these trends?
I mean, the ones that are attractive and the ones that have sort of staying power do so because they're good. They taste good, or like the bone luge, they're fun. You know, I think there's something to be said about the benefits that these things give. You know, the fact is, like, the food truck trend, which isn't a food but sort of a business model that in itself is a food trend, it hasn't just flashed in the pan and gone away because it provides a benefit for people opening food trucks that opening a restaurant doesn't. It's less expensive. It's mobile. They can test out new concepts. They're not tied down to a lease. They're not tied down to a brick and mortar location. And then for people dining there, you know, the food comes to them. There's a sense of excitement and conspicuous consumption, but there's also, it's a quicker, easier option to get lunch when you work in an office in a certain area than having to go and drive to a restaurant and sit down. And that advantage is kind of built into it. And that is the case for almost all food trends that tend to be sort of longer lasting ones rather than fads of the season.
You know, it's fascinating to me. There are clearly these fads that, like the bone luge, come out of nowhere and seem kind of ridiculous, but have a short lifespan. Others stick for a really long time. And some that seem really obvious never take off. Like, your chapter about Indian food was fascinating.
Yeah. Trends can kind of be on the uptick for a long period of time. And only when the conditions are right do they really emerge and grow into something that's national or international. Indian food's a great example. There have been people that have been trying to make it into sort of a national food trend, something like Mexican food in the way that it's really just a part of our diet, or Chinese food, for the better part of half a century. And people in the food business have been betting on this and predicting it and saying, you know, 1984 is going to be the year of Indian food, and it hasn't happened yet. It requires a combination of different factors, from, you know, immigration rates to cultural factors, like, are there movies about India? Are people traveling to India? Do we know the names of Indian movie stars or Indian American movie stars? Are there these cultural figures or foods that we're familiar with? Are there foods from other cultures, like Sriracha hot sauce and Thai food, which are close enough that they can kind of serve as an entry point to something like Indian food? All these need to be in place, and something needs to happen for them to sort of burst onto the scene.
Hmm. You know, I was really struck when I was reading your book about the effort that goes into influencing our food preferences, essentially. Is it all an exercise, do you think, in opening up new markets and getting us to spend more of our disposable income on boutique foods? Or is there some kind of conversation that we need to have about whether it's socially responsible, when people are going hungry in this country, to obsess over heirloom wheat or artisanal sausages?
It's a good point. I mean, there's that fundamental question of why should we care about this, right? Why should anyone care about food trend when there are people in the country and in our own communities who are hungry? And I think you need to look at it in another couple of ways, is that, you know, food trends are the innovative edge of the economy, and they touch everyone. It's not just wealthy people who are eating at very fancy restaurants. It's everybody who works down the line of the food industry, which is one of the biggest industries in the country, that employs people from, you know, the six-figure salaries to working wage jobs. And so with each new innovation, with each new trend, you're getting more money that's going into the pockets of those people that will then be able to feed their families. As well, these trends can have the impact of improving the food and the offerings that people who are struggling to feed themselves face. You know, the rise of the past number of years of community gardens, community-supported agriculture, organic farming is in its way its own food trend, right? As the people who are trendy foodies in these different cities pick up on that and talk about the need to, you know, be local and support community gardening, money has flowed in that direction and assisted people in those communities with that.
So do you think that there's a way in which some food trends, maybe particularly the health-oriented food trends, have potential to improve the quality of nutrition that people are getting who maybe don't have huge disposable income?
I think so. I mean, I think these things trickle down. When you think about something like organics a number of years ago was, you know, a very fringe kind of agricultural movement, and you could get organic meat and produce in crunchy smelling health food stores scented like raw almonds and patchouli. Today you can get that stuff at Walmart. You can buy organic produce at Walmart. You can get it at Costco, and it is less expensive because the market for it has grown, and so it becomes accessible to more people. And as more people talk about food, that becomes not just something for wealthy urban foodies. It becomes something that ordinary people talk about as well in their own communities. And so they demand better quality food in school lunches and in college cafeterias and as part of, you know, food stamp programs, where now people are saying, well, let us spend some of that money at CSAs. Why can't we spend our food stamps at CSAs? So I do think fundamentally it's beneficial. I don't think it's a let them eat cake kind of scenario where, you know, people are talking about cronuts and Instagramming it while, you know, the world goes hungry. I don't think it's that much of a either or.
You know, someone told me last year that he thought that food had jumped the shark, that we'd become so precious and obsessed with eating the right things and putting it up on Instagram that we'd essentially forgotten that in the end, it's food, it's nutrition. But you defend these trends. Why do you do that?
Well, listen, in the end, you know, he's partly right, your friend. In the end, it is food, nutrition, and it all ends up, you know, in the same place, to put it delicately. And yet it is tremendously important, I think. You know, food is more than just fuel. It is the way we express our culture. It is the way that we socialize. It is the way that we turn our family recipes and our identities into viable business models that employ thousands of people, whether it's, you know, a product line of snack cakes or whether it is a restaurant chain that somebody starts in their city and then grows nationwide. Food is a tremendous part of our expenditure and our income, you know, anywhere from 10% if you're quite wealthy to 30 to 40 to 50% of your paycheck. And so because it is, and because so much energy is going into it, it is something of tremendous importance. And because of that importance, where we put that money, how we spend it, how we expend our time and treasure and energy in acquiring and cooking and eating food is tremendously important. It says everything about who we are and where we live to what our social and cultural and political values are. You know, how you eat is who you are.
Well, thanks so much, David. I really appreciate your talking with us.
My pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
David Sachs is the author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. He talked with Sarah Nix. When it comes to food, everyone has an opinion. That's what producer Raymond Tangakar discovered during a recent visit to Chicago's Windy City Rib Fest, where he asked folks what they look for in food.
My name is Shelley Efrosinis. I live here in Chicago. When it comes to food, I look for fresh, interesting, and quality, high quality. Well, quality is important to me because especially if you're eating at a street festival, if it's not high quality, you're going to get really sick. I experienced that. Actually, for fruits and vegetables, I think about organic all the time. I shop at grocery stores that carry organic as much as possible. And with meat, it's important that it's hormone-free and treated humanely.
My name's Jay. I live in Old Town, Chicago. What I look for, in any meal really is first flavor. I have the fortune of having a pretty nice metabolism, which is great, but spice is very important to me. I try to use that, incorporate that pepper or any kind of spice and flavoring to anything I eat. But definitely healthy is probably the second piece of that. Try to stay healthy and fit. So when I cook, I try to incorporate the use of anything, really, from sage and basil all the way to paprika and some really hot red pepper blends that I make. And so I use that with just about any seafood, any poultry, any pork. I do ribs occasionally and incorporate that spiciness to the flavor of the food. And in addition to that, vegetables, any kind of potato mix, and a lot of different things that I make even for breakfast, frankly, with eggs. A lot of different spice to each thing, each meal.
My name is Don Gibson. I live in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in central Illinois. I look for variety, actually. So a lot of times when we're going out to eat, we try something new, different. We're always looking for something, you know, maybe something that we're familiar with, but that's got a different twist.
One second, please.
Hi, my name is Keith McCormick. I'm the executive director of the Uptown Chamber of Commerce. I think it's really important to try new things because life is too short to eat boring food. Food is a great gateway to bring people from different cultural backgrounds together. And I think it's always been that way. You know, we sit down at a table and we share a meal. I get to learn something about you and where you're from. And I think it's a great opportunity.
Now with Shelley Efrosinis, Jay Nolan, Don Gibson, and Keith McCormick at the Windy City Rib Fest in Chicago. What do you look for in food? Drop us a note on our Facebook page. Coming up, Julia Child was right. We'll remember the TV chef who told America to eat everything in moderation and with plenty of lovely butter. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. When it comes to food, perhaps no other chef did more to change the way Americans cook and eat than Julia Child. Her groundbreaking cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, introduced us to everything from basic knife skills to bœuf bourguignon. The legendary editor who brought that book to market was Judith Jones, and she reflects on their friendship in her own memoir, The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. She told Steve Paulson, it's hard to convey just how different American attitudes toward food were before Julia.
It certainly was a very different time.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps more than anybody, Julia Child awakened these repressed appetites, because it was too long we'd had this sort of Puritan heritage where food was fodder, and that was that. And about the time I came into the world, gastronomic America was at its lowest point. And what happened after the war, of course, was that not only had the GIs traveled and brought back an appetite for more interesting tastes, but every little secretary was suddenly going to Paris for the first time. It was no longer just for the elite.
Well, you were one of those people who went off to France at an early age. I mean, you went there after college, and my sense is you really discovered the glory of French cooking at that time.
I did, yeah. I was supposed to go for a two-week vacation, and I stayed 3.5 years. Fortunately, my purse was stolen when I was sitting in the Tuileries Gardens and thinking, how am I going to leave this beautiful city? And I just belong here.
And the purse had your return ticket in it as well.
It had everything, my passport, return ticket, traveler's checks, my whole identity. But instead of sort of boohooing and saying, send me some money to come home, I just went out and started looking for a job and decided that it was fate.
Now, what was it about the French and food that was so special, that was so different from the environment you grew up in?
Well, for one thing, they shopped 2 or 3 times a day, and they loved it. I can remember one particular time I was standing in the boulangerie, the bread shop. We always got our bread fresh every morning. And there was a man in front of me, and he opened up the baguette, and he cheered, and then he passed the bread around to, there were a lot of people waiting in line, and they all, the cheer just rose higher and higher, and I thought, what is this about? And I asked somebody, and they said, the flour is white. We haven't had white flour since before the war. You would just never have found that in America, that joy in something, that pride, that pure love of food. It was captivating. I just fell for it.
And there were all the specialty shops. I mean, there was the butcher and the baker and the fish shop, yeah, and the cheese store and the wine merchant.
And the charcuterie and the fromagerie. And, yep, you spent a good deal of time shopping. And I think I got to know the French in that way.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that you met your own husband when you were in France. I mean, he was an American, but happened to be over there.
He was an American. And he was discovering food in much the same way. So it was very much a shared thing. And when we came back, we wanted to continue it. But we found it hard because you couldn't find in a supermarket or even a vegetable market things like leeks and shallots and all those things we just take for granted today. Fresh herbs were unheard of, and it was mostly iceberg lettuce. And so it was frustrating. And I also realized how much I didn't know. I had learned a lot from asking people, but I didn't know the techniques of cooking, the finesse, the things that make the big difference between just a good dish and that, as Julia would say, soigner.
It seems to me that we can almost date the year when American culture came to love food. I mean, when French cuisine went mainstream in America, and it was 1961, when Julia Child and her two French co-authors came out with this massive book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
That's
And you played a pivotal role in getting that book published.
Well, somebody else might have done it, but I felt that I was just the right person. We had such sort of parallel careers, Julia and I, because we were in France at the same time. We both fell in love with cooking. It was a kind of rebellion against our families. I mean, and so it was a natural coming together.
Now, it's so fascinating reading about the whole process of getting that book published, because it wasn't as if you were just the editor who came across this great manuscript and there it was, voila, you had the book. I mean, you actually tried a lot of her recipes in your own kitchen. You read, for instance, about making boeuf bourguignon and, you know, seeing what that was like.
And the difference between Julia's instructions, she told you what meat to buy. She told you to use butter plus a little oil because the butter would burn. She told you to dry the meat because you can't brown something if it dries. You mustn't crowd the pan or it steams. Once you learn it, it's part of you. You apply it the next time.
Now, it seems that a lot of the success of that book had to do with Julia Child herself, especially once she got on television, which happened
fairly
soon.
Once she got on television, it was a miracle because I don't think there's been anyone like her since. She was totally natural, unscripted. The wonderful remark she made just came from the gut. And when she picked up the chicken and slapped it and somebody said, "Why do you massage the butter into the chicken?" she'd say, "Well, I think it likes it." And there were so many things like that that just popped out of her mouth. As I say, I think it released something that had been long repressed in people, and that is that food is fun, it's sensuous, it's creative, it's generous. I mean, you're doing it for friends and family. Enjoy it. That was just unheard of.
Now, you came to know Julia Child very well. What was she like?
Oh, she was great fun to be with. I remember once we were visiting in France for Christmas, and I went over to her house to help with the Christmas dinner. And she had a goose. But the important thing, she said, is that the feet are on that goose. I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because you want to get the tendons out, because that's what makes the legs tough." And then she took a huge knife or whatever it was and whacked the ankles and put her finger in around the tendon. Then she threw the goose on the floor with a broomstick, and then she pulled, and the whole tendon came out. And she said, "Just like pulling out the cork out of a bottle of wine." So it was just wonderful.
Now, later, you became the editor of a number of renowned cookbook writers. Claudia Roden, who wrote the classic book of Middle Eastern food. Madhur Jaffrey, who put Indian food on the map in America, and many others as well. Did these various cookbook authors have anything in common?
They did. And I made this discovery that one of the qualities that was so important is that feeling of love for this food. And they were all displaced people. Claudia grew up in Cairo and they had to leave. But she longed for the food of her childhood. That brought back her family and memories. And there was always this feeling of the recipe had that story, that history behind it, and that emotional attachment, which I think is very important. And they were also very good writers because they had to learn from scratch, just as you and I have to learn from scratch. So they understood the home cook to tell you what to anticipate and how to correct the seasonings and things like that. I found that they were really our best teachers.
And they weren't professional chefs. I mean,
they weren't professional chefs.
They were amateur cooks, in a way.
Yeah. You see, I think the professional chef lives in a whole different world. I know he does. His challenge is to do something dramatic, surprising. He gives us ideas, of course. I mean, I love to go to a restaurant sometimes just to taste something that you want to try to emulate later at home. That isn't home cooking. Home cooking is more a rhythm through the whole week, how you're going to use dishes again. And for the individual, it's really more challenging and creative.
Now, today, you are in your 80s. Your husband passed away some years back. Do you still do much cooking yourself?
Oh, I did. And I thought at first that I would find that difficult. But it was quite the opposite. I found instead that when I came home in the evening after a day at work, tired, that the one thing I wanted to do was to roll up my sleeves and see what was in the fridge, improvise a bit, and smash the garlic. Then when it's all ready, I love to put it nicely on a plate. I light the candles. I maybe turn on some music. And when I sit down, I'm really not alone. I'm with the past, in a sense, and I'm honoring something that was very important in both of our lives.
Judith Jones was an editor at Knopf for more than 50 years. Her memoir is called The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food. Steve Paulson talked with her. We've spent a lot of this hour talking about the factors behind food fads. But what about the opposite? Why do certain foods fall out of favor? Take white bread. At various points in history, it's been praised as the salvation of national health, derided as a symbol of the oppressive establishment, and recently blamed for America's obesity epidemic. Aaron Bobrow Strain teaches about food and politics at Whitman College, and he's the author of A History of White Bread. He says our anxieties about food often reflect larger social questions.
I started off, it was just a book about bread. I'm kind of an amateur baking geek, and I really wanted to write a book about bread. You know, I'm one of those stereotypical backyard chicken raising, cheese making. You know, I worked on a humane, sustainable cattle ranch that I'm part owner of, and I really like to pickle things. I really do think that, you know, the industrial food system is broken in many ways, and we need to fix it. And I looked around, and there's all these books out there that are telling us in great detail how bad our food is, and then offering some kind of fairly simplistic solutions that are basically, you know, change your diet, change the world. And it felt a little unsatisfying. And what I really thought was, like, how have groups done this in the past, right? How have people tried to change America's food system in the past? What have they succeeded at? What have they failed at? And it turns out that industrial white bread is a fun way to get at that because it's our most fought over food.
It's always been really important to us, but you're suggesting that that bread has always been political. So if we look back at the 20s or the 30s, for instance, bread became kind of a metaphor for questions about race, citizenship, immigration, even. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, we see this, say, from the 1880s into the 1920s, middle-class, native-born Americans go through, you know, what we could maybe call a moral panic about the cleanliness of bread. Newspaper headlines scream out, dangerous bakeries threaten the city, or germs lurk in your bread, and even good old mother's bread gets condemned by many scientific experts as being a potential biohazard. And it's very strange to me because I can't find any evidence that bread was actually making people sick.
So why was everybody so worried about the uncleanliness of bread?
Exactly. So when I start to go through the piles of testimonies and hearing transcripts about the quote-unquote bread problem, what I realize is that food fears about bread, cleanliness, had become inseparable from racial fears about the new, supposedly dirty, scary, threatening immigrants who were sweating away in those small bakeries and touching the bread with their hands. So in this moment where bread from local bakeries is seen as kind of scary and dark and dank and threatening, gleaming white bread coming out of these shining white factories full of stainless steel surfaces provides a kind of reassuring sense of safety for people. And this was underlying anxiety. This wasn't necessarily generated by the industrial baking sector, but they certainly benefited from it. And they start to capitalize on it. They advertise the new industrial white bread as untouched by human hands. That's the big slogan. And it was very clear that the human hands they were referring to were these supposedly scary, dirty immigrants.
Was it really clear? I mean, how do you see that connection getting made between immigrants and bread and unsanitary?
There's this great moment in a hearing that takes place in New York in the 19-teens, where commissioners are interviewing witness after witness after witness, and all the witnesses are testifying about how horrific the conditions are for immigrant bakers. They were working 18-hour days. They were working in these dark, unventilated, overheated basement bakeries. They had tuberculosis because the air quality was so bad. But the commissioners reframe it as a question of how do we protect the consumer from these bad immigrant bakers. And there's this moment where the one commissioner is asking the guys, you know, well, do you think that these bakers could be taught to have clean habits? The witness says, well, yes, I do think that. And the commissioner says something like, no, not really. These people are inherently unclean. And the other guy says, well, no, I think they could be reformed. And I realized at that moment they were not talking about bread anymore. They were talking about the nature of immigration and the nature of new immigrants.
And citizenship, right?
Right. And I think that gets at a central point of the book, is that our fears and our anxieties, even our desires and hopes about food, are often really not about food. They're about much bigger social questions.
How do you see that right now in debates about food and in particular about bread?
I think that we're in an interesting moment right now where a lot of our anxieties and aspirations and desires around food and bread in particular deal with notions of class. Industrial white bread has gone from being an icon of progress and responsible parenting, even national strength and patriotism, to being an emblem of poverty, ill health, and poor choices. And in that shift, what we've seen is a kind of segmentation of the bread market along class lines. Industrial white bread has become synonymous with white trash. Mm-hmm. And I think it is this shift between the counterculture and something that happens in the 70s and 80s, right? In the 60s, the counterculture takes up industrial white bread as everything that's wrong with America, right? It's bland, it's chemical, it's corporate. There's the slogan, don't eat white, eat right. Right?
There's this great quotation, Diana Vreeland said, people who eat white bread have no dreams.
Right. So it's already a kind of a moralizing force there. But it isn't just about health, right? Beatrice Thrum Hunter, who's an influential Whole Foods advocate at that moment, talks about how baking your own whole wheat bread is an act of revolt against the mechanization of life, an act of social revolt. So to eat non-white bread was to be part of a great collective social change. By the Reagan years, that sense of collective rebellion gets folded into a kind of individualistic, consumer-driven self-actualization movement, right? Where, for better or for worse, the whole wheat bread is really not about creating larger social change. It's about improving oneself, being individually more healthy, better looking, more successful.
Isn't the subtext here that all of these food reform movements, those in the past and then by extension those in the present right now, are all misguided because to a certain extent we're not really talking about food. We're talking about these other underlying social issues.
Exactly. The real lesson here is that food movements have focused too much on trying to change individual food choices. And I know that kind of sounds a little counterintuitive, right? Because shouldn't food movements try to change our food choices?
Mm-hmm.
But what I see is when you look at these battles over bread, two things tend to happen when food movements focus so much on individual food choices. Whether they're focusing on trying to get us to eat more industrial white bread or trying to get us to eat no industrial white bread or trying to get us to eat, you know, local food, whatever. When they focus on trying to change the world through changing individual food choices, even the most well-meaning of us food reformers end up reinforcing social divides between the, you know, the supposedly virtuous us who knows how to make the right choices about food and then the pitiful, in need of help them who can't seem to make the right choices about food. And there's a lot of people out there talking about that now. Let's go help the poor make better choices. But at root, our food problems are about income. And there's all kinds of studies that show that poor people would eat better food if they had more income. Average wages have been stagnant for most people in the United States since the 1970s. Inequality is growing at phenomenal rates. As a food historian, I think that when we look back at our obesity crisis in 40, 50 years, we'll see that we didn't have a problem with uneducated people making the wrong choices about food and needing to be told otherwise, so much as we had a problem with stagnant wages and a highly concentrated food system where a few companies basically get away with setting the terms for how the country eats.
Aaron Bobrow Strain is the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. And that's it for Thinking About Food. When we come back, Israeli radio host Mishi Harman shares a bookmark, and with tensions flaring in the Middle East, we'll take a closer look at the city of Jerusalem. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks. This week's reading suggestion comes from Mishi Harman, host of the Hebrew language radio show Israel Story.
Today I want to talk to you about my favorite book, which is called A Tale of Love and Darkness, and it's by the Israeli author Amos Oz, and it came out about 12 years ago. The book is an autobiographical novel in which Amos Oz goes back to the scenes of his childhood in Jerusalem in the 40s and 50s, and he weaves together these tales of his ancestors in these small Ukrainian shtetls and Russian villages coming to the hot Levant of the British Mandate and mingling with local Arabs in colorful markets, and these scenes of people dancing in the street after they hear on the radio that the UN decided to partition the land and create a Jewish state and the establishment of the state and the bloody war of independence. And with all of these historic events happening more personally, he tells the story of living in this small one-bedroom apartment full of books and atlases with parents in a completely dysfunctional marriage, and how ultimately he leaves his father's home when he's 15 and he moves to a kibbutz, and the sort of last straw is that he changes his family name from the European-sounding Klausner to the Israeli, almost militant-sounding Oz, which means strength or might. I first read this book during my first year in the army, and it met me at a particularly meaningful time when, for the first time really, I was trying to navigate between these two main tenets of my upbringing at home: loving your country and serving it proudly on the one hand, and being a liberal, socially minded humanitarian who's all into peace with our neighbors on the other. And here I was in the army, and these two tenets seemed to clash every day. But A Tale of Love and Darkness was this illuminating map for me, which kind of showed me the way to reconcile these two ideas. And here Amos Oz, this high priest of the left, was not apologetic about our right to live here and our right for a Jewish state, and also not afraid to be just as forceful about the Palestinians' right to live here and for them to have a state. So for years, until today really, I often pick up the book and open it at a random chapter, and I tour with it in the streets of Jerusalem and imagine with it kind of nostalgically what Jerusalem, my beautiful city, was like 65 years ago. And you know, it's almost impossible to imagine how much Jerusalem has changed since then and grown and become more religious and less tolerant and more divisive. But in many ways, it's also the same Jerusalem in which I grew up, the same streets, the same smells, the same neighborhood characters that you can recognize. And that's, I think, what I really like about the book, that it is both very foreign and at the same time completely familiar.
That was Israel Story radio host Mishi Harman. He recommends A Tale of Love and Darkness by Amos Oz. You can hear more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And it's time for On Our Minds. This week, with tensions flaring between Israel and Hamas, we've been thinking about the city of Jerusalem, which is once again seeing rocket attacks. How can a city that so many faiths consider sacred have inspired so much violence over the centuries? Boston Globe columnist James Carroll explored that question in his book, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Why are you so fascinated by the city of Jerusalem?
When I was a young Catholic priest,
confronting a crisis of faith in the early 1970s, having had most of my attitudes politically and religiously transformed by the anti-war movement in the Vietnam years, I went to Jerusalem for a summer-long retreat to reckon with my situation. Could I stay in the priesthood? Could I maintain my faith in Jesus Christ? Could I continue to be a Catholic? Large questions. And in Jerusalem, I reckoned far more deeply with myself, my traditions, my faith, than I ever imagined possible.
So there was something about that sacred space, that city,
the place itself,
with all of its history.
And, you know, as has been the case for multitudes and multitudes, to be in the ground itself of a place where human beings back 5-6 millennia have encountered the holy for good and for ill, to be there is an absolutely transforming experience. Anyone who knows Jerusalem is a little less mystified, for example, by the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, because there is something absolute about this place. And so,
what do you mean, absolute?
For example, the rock on the top of the hill, the legendary Mount Zion that gives Jerusalem one of its names, is the rock on which primitive people carried out sacrifices to their gods. It's remembered as the rock to which Abraham was bringing Isaac in the defining will to sacrifice that actually marked the end of human sacrifice in the biblical tradition. It's the rock over which the Holy of Holies of the Temple of Solomon was built. It's the rock that therefore marked the magnetic draw for Jesus of Nazareth when he came to Jerusalem and committed who knows what exactly. And it's the rock then that Christians began to denigrate after the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 as they revered Jesus as the new temple. And it's the rock to which Islamic forces were drawn within 5 years of the death of Muhammad. And it's the absolute heartbeat of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. So that's what makes it absolute is human beings from a variety of experiences and a whole range of cultures have experienced this cockpit, let's call it a cockpit of violence. This cockpit has drawn all the great powers of the Western world down through the millennia. They've often come into conflict with one another there. And therefore, it has been the place, I would argue more than any other, where human beings have fought back against violence, looking for ways to mitigate it and end it.
Now, so, what you're doing here is, I mean, you're suggesting something very provocative, which is that Jerusalem is not only a central place to the history, to the origins of these three Abrahamic religions. You also cannot talk about that history without violence. I mean, they go together.
The truth is, the biblical tradition out of which Christianity and Islam spring is a tradition that is set against violence. What you have in these people is a rather desperate human attempt to find ways out from under the threat of violence. How is it that the human species has not made itself extinct by now? The history I track in Jerusalem, Jerusalem, is a history of human beings again and again and again turning violence against itself, finding ways to mitigate it, as I say. It fails again and again. Human beings constantly getting sucked back into violence. The story of Jesus, he lives in an extremely violent world, the savage Roman occupation, setting himself against violence, and then his story embraced and celebrated 30 or 40 years after his death in the composition of the Gospels, which highlight his nonviolence against the Roman violence that is killing Israel at that moment, literally, the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. So the story of Jesus in this tradition, I argue that the very idea of the oneness of God, so-called monotheism, is itself an act of peacemaking because it's a repudiation of the idea that each tribe has its own God and each God blesses the violence of that tribe against all the other tribes. No, this God is the God of all the tribes. This God is everyone's God. Therefore, this God is a principle of reconciliation among the tribes. That's the vision of Genesis.
Okay, let me follow up on this, because it sounds like you're saying now that these religions, well, you mentioned Islam and Christianity in particular, as forming in reaction to the violence of the time. But I also get the sense that you're saying that you really can't talk about those religions without understanding that there's some violent impulses within the religions themselves.
Well, the violent impulses are within the human condition, and the religions are not exempt from that. So the religions get sucked back into this violent impulse. So you do get the pacifist Jesus, let's call him that, but you also then get the Jesus people scapegoating the Jews when they tell his story, generating the violence of anti-Semitism down through the centuries. So that's the dynamic right there. You get the oneness of God embraced by Muhammad, a principle of peace, but you also get the jihadist impulse, Muslims killing people in the name of that God. So Islam, similar to Christianity, getting sucked back into that violence.
Let me come back to what we were talking about earlier, getting back to Jerusalem and these competing claims for this particular city among the three monotheistic religions. There are rival claims to truth here, and it would seem that that is also one of the great problems in religion. I mean, if a Christian says, you know, I have a unique insight into truth that your religion does not, what do you do with that?
That's a great point. It goes to, again, the crucial insight that came to human beings in Jerusalem, which is that no human being has a corner on the truth. No human being has an absolute grasp of the truth. We all see it darkly. We all see it aslant. The truth is absolute, but we are not. And so none of us has an absolute grasp on it. The great symbol of the way God is present to this people was, do you remember what? Do you remember what was in the Holy of Holies? Nothing. The Holy of Holies was vacant. It was empty. No gold, no image, no treasure, no picture, nothing. This God is present to the people in absence. This God cannot be represented, therefore. You know that. It's a sacred tradition of Judaism and Islam both. What we know about God is that God ultimately is unknowable. And that's a kind of knowledge. It's a sacred knowledge. That, therefore, leads to my religion over against your religion. If we're both at the mercy of an incomplete knowledge of God, neither of us can make an absolute truth claim over the other.
Well, let's go back to Jerusalem, because you say that there are really two Jerusalems. There's the actual place, and then there's the idea of Jerusalem, sort of the place that it's occupied in the imaginations of people over the years. And of course, there's always been talk about a new Jerusalem, or perhaps to rephrase it a different way, the city on the hill. Mm-hmm. Is that still a resonant symbol today?
Well, it goes so deeply into our psyches and imaginations, and it begins in tragedy. The book of Revelation, the last book of the Christian New Testament, is a description of the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans during the Roman War. It's a savage book. It's a book that transforms the Roman destruction into the destruction by God at the end of history. And it's a vision of the destruction of the earthly Jerusalem for the sake of a new heavenly Jerusalem, perfect, the perfect place where we'll all finally be at peace, we'll all be in justice, the Messiah will have returned. And it defines a kind of human hope that sees the imagination of Europe and then of America. And so it was the most natural thing in the world for the Puritan settlers from England in 1620 and 1630 to think of what they were doing as establishing, as John Winthrop called it, the city on a hill. The first idea America had of itself, the New Jerusalem, the place finally of perfect peace, justice, the true peaceable kingdom. That was the vision those folks had. They were motivated by it. And as has been true, as we said earlier in our conversation, again and again and again, humans get sucked back into the violence of the real human condition. So no sooner had they articulated that lovely, beautiful vision of Jerusalem, they named their first settlement Salem, which is another name for Jerusalem, Salem, Massachusetts. No sooner had they articulated this vision than they began to betray it by violence in the name of it, violence first inflicted against native peoples whom they found here, and then violence against one another, against dissenters in the peaceable communion, murdering, for example, Mary Dyer, a dissenting Puritan woman who was hung on Boston Common, expelling, scapegoating Ian Hutchinson, expelling, scapegoating Roger Williams. This contest among those first Puritans led to the first draft of the New American Idea, with Roger Williams understanding that for the city on the hill to be real, the individuals who live there have to have their consciences respected. And he was the one who came up with the idea that the magistrate's first obligation is to protect the integrity of each citizen's conscience, which requires religious neutrality by the magistrate, the idea that ultimately evolves into the separation of church and state. A beautiful idea, an idea that then becomes central to the next iterations of the city on a hill, the American dream of freedom, democracy, and equality, the last best hope of earth, in Lincoln's phrase, that finally in the time of Woodrow Wilson motivates Americans to go abroad and impose it violently on others. Wilson sent missionaries abroad, but they were always followed by the U.S. Marines. And the next thing you know, we're in the thick of a Cold War where we're prepared actually to blow up the world to protect an idea of American sacred freedom, the free world. The apocalyptic readiness to use nuclear weapons comes right out of these deep strains of the human condition, going right back to Jerusalem.
James Carroll is a Boston Globe columnist and scholar in residence at Suffolk University. He was talking about his book, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, How the Ancient City Ignited Our Modern World. And you can hear an extended version of his conversation with Steve on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from a city that on some days and in certain lights seems like the city on the hill, Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music composed our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for joining us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.